Great. I talked this morning a bit about the various parallels that scholars have brought into the interpretation of the sayings in the Synoptic Gospels about Jesus coming. Jesus says, as I mentioned earlier, I have come in order to do such and such on many and various occasions. And one of the key parallels I mentioned that scholars bring in is one from Josephus, where Josephus also says to the Roman emperor, I have come in order to be a messenger to you of great destinies. Now, I explained why I think that that's not a very good parallel to the I have come sayings of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, and Luke's Gospels. And so this lecture is going to be focused on the proper Old Testament and Jewish backgrounds to the I have come sayings of Jesus. It's critical, of course, to whenever we're looking at the New Testament texts, to get exactly right what the proper Jewish Old Testament context of that is, because obviously if we're looking at a particular theme in the Gospels or elsewhere in the New Testament, if we put it up against one aspect of the Old Testament and then put it up against a different aspect of the Old Testament, then we might well come up with a different view of what the passage is about. So we can't just choose any old passage from the Old Testament which happens to have the same wording that our New Testament passage has. It's key to sort of evaluate critically which is the appropriate Old Testament and Jewish background, and then to distinguish which is inappropriate background to bring in. Just to recap on the previous lecture, I outlined, if you remember, if you were here, the common scholarly paradigm in which Jesus is gradually, in the course of the first century, in the course of the New Testament period, gradually understood as first prophet, then Messiah, then a semi-divine Lord figure, and finally God incarnate. And I gave three reasons why I was suspicious of this early Christian history, as put forward by many scholars. And this present lecture aims to supply a third reason for my, fourth reason, I suppose, for my suspicion. And in fact, this lecture and the final lecture tomorrow over lunch will, I hope, not only cast suspicion on this paradigm, but actually contradict it. I noted again in the previous lecture that the I have come saying, I have come plus purpose formula, the idea of saying, I have come in order to cast fire on the earth and such like, this was not a way of speaking whereby normal people wandering around on the Galilean mountainsides would sum up their life's work. Not even a Messiah or a prophet figure in the Old Testament, not even a prophetic figure in the Old Testament would sum up his ministry by saying, I have come to proclaim whatever it is, God's message. Rather, I'm saying that this is a distinctive formula that has a distinctive Old Testament background, not prophetic, not messianic, but as follows. I'm going to argue today that the I have come plus purpose formula, and these various summary statements are on your handout. I'm going to argue that the I have come plus for purpose formula in the Gospels is most closely and most abundantly paralleled in the announcements by angels of their comings from heaven. So, again, the attempt is to provide a firmer background for the I have come sayings of Jesus than scholars have previously managed to offer. Critically, then, angels do sum up the totality of an earthly visit that they're paying to the human sphere by this phrase, I have come plus a purpose. And they can do this because they have come from a pre-existence in heaven. Angels have a prior existence in heaven before they come to visit whoever it is, Daniel or whoever in the Old Testament. So this isn't something that can be said by an ordinary human person to sum up their life's work, but it is said by a heavenly figure. So in this lecture I'm going to look at a number of these examples. As I said, a number of these examples may well be very obscure, seem like they're from very obscure texts. Well, I hope that's all to the good, because I hope that it's a sort of learning experience getting to know some of these new and strange Jewish texts. For the first six examples, I'm just going to go through the examples that are on your handout. The first six are from a book that I hope you are familiar with, the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. And these first two examples come in Daniel 9. And as you may know, in Daniel 9, Daniel recalls the prophecy of Jeremiah that God is going to restore the nation of Israel after a certain period of time. And so Daniel prays to God in accordance with this prophecy that God would act on it. And Daniel reports that at exactly the time that he started praying, Gabriel visited him at the time of the evening sacrifice. And so the angel then declares in Daniel 9:22-23, if you want to follow on your handouts. And he instructed me, this is Daniel speaking, he instructed me and conversed with me, Gabriel did, and said, Daniel, I have come forth now to give you understanding. As soon as you began to pray, a message went forth, and I have come to announce to you that you are a man highly favored. So a message, a revelation from God is issued in the heavenly court, and God commissions Gabriel to go and take this message to Daniel. So in quick succession, we have two examples of the angel Gabriel saying, I have come in order to, in this case, reveal something to Daniel. The next four examples are from Daniel 10 and the beginning of Daniel 11. Here, Daniel sees a vision of a man who is nevertheless obviously an angelic figure. Sometimes angelic figures are seen as, are described as a man, but you know from their, in this case, you know from their shining appearance, their shining clothes, and from the fact that Daniel is seeing this in a vision, that it's not simply a human being, but an angelic figure. This man tells Daniel, again, that he's highly favored, and tells Daniel to stand up and listen, because I have now been sent to you, he says in verse 11 of Daniel 10. And this is a common feature that when angels say, I have come, they often talk in the same context of having been sent, because obviously having been sent by God from the heavenly sphere and coming to humanity in the human sphere are sort of two sides of the same coin, being sent by God and coming. So this man, in inverted commas, says, and he said, Daniel reporting the visit, said that the figure says, do not fear, Daniel, because from the first day on which you gave your heart to understand and to be humbled, your words were heard before God, and I have come on account of your words. Now here we don't have a strict purpose clause, I have come in order to, but the angel does say, I have come because of your words. And the clear implication is that he's coming to answer Daniel's prayers. That's the obvious point that the angel is making. But he does talk about a second purpose as well. In verse 14, I have come to reveal to you what will happen to your people at the end of days, because your vision is for those days. Then another angel comes to Daniel later on in the chapter and says to him, do you know why I have come to you? Again, the implication of purpose, although not a purpose clause, the why implies that the angel is talking about coming with a purpose. He doesn't state the purpose, of course, because that's precisely why he's asking Daniel why, if he knows why. But he is making a statement about his purpose. And the angel answers his own question in that this final reference from Daniel in chapter 11, verse 2, saying, in the first year of Cyrus the king, he, that's the Lord, told me to strengthen him and give him courage. And now the angel says, but now I have come to reveal the truth to you. So this language is very similar to the rest of the language in Daniel, and a special focus on angels saying, I have come in order to reveal something particular that they've been commissioned to reveal by God from the heavenly council to come into the human realm to speak. The angel then is summarizing the reason in this I have come plus purpose, summarizing the reason for his visit to the human sphere. Next, we delve into some of the more arcane Jewish texts from the period. Perhaps Not many of you in this room, perhaps not any, have heard of the Sodei Raza, the secrets of the angel Raziel, because this is a text connected with the angel Raziel, who's a rabbinic angel. And this is a little known Hebrew text, probably from the early rabbinic period. Some scholars date it to around 1st century BC, 1st century AD. And some connect it not with the rabbis, but with earlier groups with who are sort of connected and similar to those of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This work is probably part of a sequel to 1 Enoch, if you've heard of that text. The work begins with a prayer of Adam, and after Adam's prayer, the angel Raziel comes and addresses him. And he says to Adam, "I have come to make known to you pure words and great wisdom, and in order to make you wise by the words of this holy book." So Raziel gives the explanation for his coming in these terms: to make known something to Adam and to make him wise. He's actually giving Adam a holy book, as it's mentioned here. And this is, as is common in Jewish apocalyptic literature, often the heavenly secrets are passed on in the form of a book. This book is then given by Adam to Enoch, who learns all about the courses of the heavenly stars from it and about the names of the various angels. And then Noah is the next person to pick up this book in the succession of this text as it's passed on. And it's how Noah learns how to build the ark. So, pretty important book. Number 8, the Apocalypse of Moses. This is a text that's probably more secure, that we can say pretty definitely was written in the 1st century AD or the 2nd century AD, around that time. And it's a revelation to Moses of some of the events which took place at the beginning of creation and then later on. Often we associate an apocalypse with things that are talked about happening at the end of time. This is a book which tells you what happens at the beginning of time. And it's probably a sort of explanation by early Jews to when they were sort of reflecting on the fact of how on earth does Moses know what happened in the Garden of Eden? Sort of stands to reason. If you think that Moses wrote the Pentateuch, then you might wonder how on earth did he know what went on in the Garden of Eden? Well, the answer that one early Jew came up with was, well, Moses must have had a divine revelation about these events, and that's what's reported in this book, The Apocalypse of Moses. Now, when he gets on to talking about the fall, and especially Eve's role in the fall, Eve describes to her descendants how this fall came about, and she recounts that the devil calls the serpent. They're not completely the exact same person, but the serpent is a sort of helper of the devil, according to this apocalypse. And the devil says, "I have come to observe you, having discovered that you were greater than all the animals." So this, in this case, it's not an angel, but the devil who comes into the human sphere, into the Garden of Eden, to observe the serpent and to get him to carry out his purposes. So the devil journeys to earth, and the serpent is initially reluctant, but the devil talks him into tempting Eve. The next two examples come from the fourth book of Ezra, so-called. We actually mentioned it this morning in the discussion of the Messiah figures in early Jewish texts. This one was the one which has a pre-existent Messiah, like the four Gospels. And it dates from the end of the 1st century AD, and we know this pretty definitely because it talks about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD having recently happened, and it's a Jewish reflection on how on earth God can do this to Israel. How can God punish Israel with the destruction of her central institution, the temple, when Israel is more righteous than the other nations? And it's precisely these other unrighteous nations that have wrought havoc on Israel. So there's a great degree of scholarly consensus that 4 Ezra dates to the end of the 1st century. At the end of it's divided up into various visions that Ezra has, in which he's visited by angels. And this second vision, the angel Uriel is the one who commonly visits Ezra, he states the following. I have come to show you these things tonight. If therefore you will pray again and fast again for 7 days, I will again declare to you greater things than these, for your voice has surely been heard before the Most High. For the Mighty One has seen your uprightness and has observed the purity which you maintained from your youth. Therefore he sent me to show you all these things. Later on, after the famous speech by Ezra, which I mentioned, where Ezra is lamenting the fact that God has given the Israel over to the hands of the nations, when in fact God should be giving the nations over to Israel, then Uriel replies to Ezra as follows. Rise, Ezra, and listen to the words which I have come to speak to you. Rise, Ezra, and listen to the words which I've come to speak to you. So again, in these two examples from 4 Ezra, again, a very clear pattern of I have come plus purpose clause. Just as in the synoptic I have come sayings in Matthew, Mark and Luke. Again, very closely related to 4 Ezra is an apocalypse called 2 Baruch, the apocalypse of Baruch in Syriac. Again, the context is the destruction of Jerusalem. Again, it's a lament over why God has allowed this to happen. And you can see again in the quotation from to Baruch here that, again, it's a purpose clause. Ramael, the angel who addresses Baruch, the angel Ramael, has just talked again about having been sent by God and then addresses Baruch as one who has come. So this is the vision which you have seen, Mr. Baruch, and this is its explanation. For I have come to tell you these things since your prayer has been heard by the Most High. Again, it's sort of very much dependent on the language that we saw in Daniel, isn't it? It was sort of similar idea of Baruch being a person who's highly favoured, so he prays and then an angel comes and replies. Another important type of literature in the early Jewish period is the genre of the Testament. Now, in this, what you frequently have is an old patriarch of Israel, like Abraham or Isaac or Jacob, or most commonly Jacob's various sons, who on their deathbeds pronounce great prophecies of what is going to happen in the future. So it's a way of Jews in the second, in the sort of roughly New Testament period, talking about how God had actually mapped out the course of history all along, because here, lo and behold, we can see that Isaac or Jacob has foreseen what was going to happen in these last days. One of these is the Testament of Isaac, which is where our next example comes from. This is generally dated to around the 2nd century AD, and there's a little bit of controversy over whether this is actually a Jewish text rather than a Christian text. Sometimes with a lot of these Jewish texts, they've been transmitted, they've been passed down actually by Christians, even though they were originally Jewish texts. So this is true of a lot of the apocalyptic literature from early Judaism. The Jewish groups in which they were used died out, and perhaps when destruction of Jerusalem took place, a lot of the Jewish copies were lost, but they were preserved in Christian circles. So, for example, probably one of the most famous apocalypses, 1 Enoch, is actually still used in the canon of the Ethiopian church even today, and so has been passed down from near the beginning to the present day through that particular Christian group, which is why we have it in Ethiopic and not any language which most of us can understand. So this Testament of Isaac, which is actually also one which survives in Ethiopic, is probably a Jewish text. One of the ways in which you can tell whether it's a Jewish or a Christian text is whether the Christian bits in it look like they've obviously been added in a sort of unsubtle editing way, and whether if you take them out, then the text still makes sort of good sense. That's one way. And this is one text, the Testament of Isaac, where scholars think that if you chop out the Christian bits, the text works equally well in terms of its argument. Someone once tried to persuade me that, I remember I went to a Dead Sea Scrolls conference, and Someone tried to explain to me that all the references to Jesus in Romans had been added in later. I think Romans is probably a text where you could say that if you chop out the Christian bits, then it doesn't still continue to make sense very well. This chap was trying to persuade me that Jesus and Josephus were the same person. You get a lot of loonies at Dead Sea Scrolls conferences, actually. But the Testament of Isaac is on at the other end of the spectrum. If you the Christian bits look like they're later insertions. So here, before Isaac died, as I say, these are deathbed scenes in these testaments. Before Isaac dies, he was visited by the archangel Michael. And Michael says to a fearful and trembling Isaac, "Be courageous in your spirit, for I come near to you from the presence of God in order to bring you up to heaven, into the presence of your father Abraham and all the holy ones." So I come near to you. First person, I come followed by a purpose clause. Michael wants to come in order to bring Isaac's soul to God. 13thly, probably not a word you hear very frequently, 13thly, the Jeremiah Apocryphon. Again, this is a very rare text, not very well known to biblical scholars. It's only been translated into English for the first time in the last couple of decades. And again, here there's been discussion over whether it was originally a Jewish text or whether it was a Christian text, first and foremost. And various versions survive in various different languages. The most important version is in Garshuni. Does anyone know what Garshuni is? Type of Arabic. Yeah, the language Garshuni is actually the Syriac language in Arabic script. Yeah, so there you have it. Again, it's if you want to write a secret apocalyptic text, then what better than to write it in one language but in the script of another? You know, keep it secret. This work, the Jeremiah Apocryphon, is centered on it's based on the book of Jeremiah. It's kind of rewriting of what happens in Jeremiah. And it's about the exile of Israel first, but then the ultimate restoration. And what happens is that just before the restoration, the archangel Michael comes to Jeremiah and tells him what's going to happen. And he says, I quote, "Jeremiah, chosen one of God, behold, I tell you, I have come to redeem this people and to take them to the land of their fathers. I have come to redeem this people." Next, we turn to a few examples of texts where a certain Old Testament passage has been modified. We've talked a lot about how various incidents in the Old Testament have been totally reshaped and everything, but this is specific Old Testament passages which, when they're translated and interpreted, take on the significance of angels coming to say, "I have come in order to do such and such." So in Numbers 22, the next example comes from that. In Numbers 22, the angel of the Lord, when he's coming to Balaam, says, "I have come as an opponent to you." Now, the Hebrew is a bit ambiguous here. It may be that in the original Hebrew, there is an "I have come" plus purpose. But there certainly is in the various translations, in the Targums and in the Vulgate, the Latin translation of this. So here, it's clear that in the Targum, the angel of the Lord says to Balaam, "Why did you strike your ass these three times? Behold, I have come out to oppose you." And then the Aramaic there, because the Targums are the early translations of the Old Testament into Aramaic. Similarly, with the Vulgate there, "I have come to oppose you." In the next four examples, 15 to 17 and then 18, we have the translations of the famous scene in which Joshua is confronted by the angel of the Lord, who is the captain of the armies of the Most High. Now, if you know the original stories, you'll know it's a bit strange. Suddenly, out of the blue, you get this reference to the angel of the Lord confronting Joshua. And Joshua asks this angel of the Lord whether he's on his side or not. Quite sort of useful piece of information to know, because this angel of the Lord has appeared with a sword, and so Joshua wants to know whose side he's on. In the Targum, this is expanded into a longer discussion where we have statements by the angel about what it is that he's exactly come to do. So I'll give you unfortunately this hasn't been translated into English, so I've had to, using my rusty Aramaic, come up with a translation of this Targum. Joshua fell before the angel of the Lord here on the ground and asked him and said to him, "Is it to support us that you have come? Or do you belong to our enemies and seek to kill?" And the angel of the Lord says to him, "I have not come to support, and I am not an enemy." I've not come to help, in other words, and I'm not an enemy. "But as the angel who is sent from Yahweh, I have come to complain because of the evening in which you neglected the sacrifice and today have neglected Torah study." So why have you come? The angel replies, "Well, I've come because you've neglected to study the Torah and you've neglected to do the sacrifices." And then Joshua asks, "For which of these particular ones reasons have you come?" And then the angel says again, mysteriously, "I have not come to support you, I've not come to help you." And Joshua fell on his face. I suppose the interesting thing here is that if you remember from the brief glance through the examples in Matthew, Mark and Luke this morning, what we get in a lot of them is Jesus saying, "I have not come in order to do this, but I have come to do this. Do not think that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Do not think that I've come to bring peace on the earth. I've not come to bring peace, but a sword." And similarly here, you have that same antithetical way of speaking by the angel of the Lord in this Targum. "I have not come to support, I have come to complain. I have not come to help, but to complain." So this example, I think, is particularly reminiscent of those examples in the Synoptic Gospels. Number 18, from the Midrash Tanhuma to Exodus. This is a Midrash, a rabbinic kind of a commentary, but not like a commentary that we would expect. Very sort of expansive commentary, bringing in lots of other verses. But when it brings in a parallel verse, it doesn't just sort of mention it briefly. It then goes into a whole extra commentary on that parallel verse, and then so on and so on. And so you can go for pages and pages and pages, a bit like some of those New International Greek commentaries on one verse. Mentioning no names. Oh, why not? Well, Greg Beale. If you know Greg Beale's New International Greek Greek commentary on Revelation, you know, when you get to the theme of the temple, suddenly there's an excursus for 20 pages on, you know, the worldwide temple and sanctuary in Isaiah. Sorry, Greg. So that explains why in this Midrash to Exodus, you suddenly have this big long explanation. I've only given you a tiny snippet here. You get this big long explanation of why of Joshua 5. This is a text that comes probably from around the 3rd, 4th century AD. So some of these Jewish texts that I'm mentioning are a bit sort of after the New Testament period, but the reason I'm bringing in is not because I'm saying that one particular text here is in the mind of Jesus and the authors of the Synoptic Gospels when they use the "I've come" sayings, but it's a whole sort of sweep of Jewish tradition in which this is a thing commonly said by angels. So in this particular example, the Midrash Tanhuma, he's talking about the angel of the Lord and what the angel of the Lord does in Exodus, but then goes on to what the angel of the Lord does with Joshua. This is the kind of second coming of the angel of the Lord, if you like, in rabbinic tradition. "Joshua saw the angel," says, quoting the text, Joshua saw the angel and fell down before him. What did he say to him? In Joshua 5:13, are you for us and for our adversaries? This is again this same discussion that we just looked at. When he, Joshua, said to him, the angel, are you for us? The angel began to cry in great anguish. No, but I am the captain of the Lord's hosts. Now I have come. Here are two times that I have come to give Israel an inheritance. I am the one who came in the days of your master Moses, but he rejected me. The angel of the Lord is said to have come to Moses to bring about the Exodus, but Moses turned him down. But now Joshua has been has given the angel a bit more of a warm reception. Number 19. Again, as with the example of the devil coming to visit the serpent in the Testament of the Apocalypse of Moses, here we have again the devil coming to, or the angel of death coming to Moses. Apparently it was quite hard to get Moses to die. God, in rabbinic tradition anyway, God first of all sent the archangel Michael to go and bring Moses' soul. But Michael refused because apparently Michael had been Moses' teacher. So God sends the angel of death, the angel who gets the name Samael in rabbinic tradition. And the angel, Moses is quite a sort of brave guy, so he says to the angel of death, what are you doing here? I'm not going to follow you. But the angel says, I have come to bear away your breath. L'tol nishmatecha. So again, an angelic figure saying, I have come in order to do such and such. Finally, the latest example, last reference from the Midrash was probably again quite a late one, from 5th, 6th century AD, and this last one is very late, from the 10th century. Again, I'm trying to give a sort of impression of a long sweep, a long tradition of angels doing this that goes right back to Daniel, and then onto the text from around the time of Jesus, and then on much later again. Just retrieve my watch. So this comes from the vision of Daniel, which can be dated fairly securely to the 10th century AD because it has references to certain Christian emperors. And the text is preserved in a Hebrew manuscript, written in Hebrew, and was found in Cairo. And it goes, the key bit for our purposes goes as follows, in the quote on the handout. I, Daniel, stood by the river Hebar, and the dread vision was heavy upon me, and I was amazed. And there came to me Gabriel, captain of the heavenly host, and he said to me, know, beloved man, and hearken, I have come to tell you that the mighty Holy One commanded me, go, Gabriel, and reveal to Daniel what is to be at the end of days. Again, the common theme of angelic visits to Daniel, that they come to reveal something to him. In all these texts, we get a big variety of purposes in what these angels come to do. Remember, Michael has come to redeem the people of Israel in the Apocryphon of Jeremiah. In the previous text about the angel of the Lord, the angel of the Lord comes to give Israel an inheritance. Again, though, in these texts, which are more dependent on Daniel, there's a strong emphasis on the revelation that the angel has come to accomplish. But what they all have in common is that they have this formula, I have come in order to do such and such. So, if you're not completely worn out by these all these 20 examples, then you can actually look at the extra ones, which I also discuss in the book that I'm working on at the moment. But perhaps you've had more than enough already. As I say, the main purpose of bombarding you with all these examples is to try and show that these are not only the closest parallels to the I have come sayings of Jesus, but they're also by far the most abundant parallels. They're the closest because, unlike the Josephus example that I mentioned, the Josephus example, remember, wasn't like the I have come sayings of Jesus, because Josephus, when he said I have come to you, Vespasian, was just talking about an individual incident of his life. Whereas these angels, when they talk about their comings to earth, are summing up their whole earthly mission by using this I have come plus purpose formula. In that respect, they're the closest parallels to the sayings of Jesus, but also they're by far the most abundant. I've given you 20 here, there are more, but scholars often just struggle to provide this one Josephus example when they try to argue that Jesus is only a prophet here. Again, the I have come plus purpose formula is not a way of speaking that was used by ordinary people or even by prophetic figures. It's not something that's used, said by normal people to sum up their life's destiny. So I would argue again that there's good grounds for reading these I have come sayings of Jesus in a more literal way, as referring to a coming from A to B, not in an idiomatic sense, but Jesus saying, I have come from somewhere in order to cast fire on the earth or whatever. The place of origin implied as heaven. I'm not arguing that Jesus is here depicted as merely an angel, although certainly there is a lot in common in the way Jesus speaks with the way in which the angel of the Lord speaks, and we could talk about that sometime as well. But in conclusion, the key point is that the comings of Jesus, which I'm going to talk about more in the lunch lecture tomorrow, the coming of Jesus is specifically identified as a coming with a purpose, implying Jesus not originally doing the things that he was going to do, but resolving to take on flesh and to do them in the earthly sphere. And it's this element of Jesus' own prior intent before his action, his prior intent to carry out this action, that hasn't been sufficiently recognized by scholars, I would argue, hasn't been sufficiently recognized in previous analyses of the I have come sayings. And as a result, the implication of his pre-existence prior to his coming has also been missed. And we'll see in the following lecture, I realize that this has been a journey into uncharted lands for many of you, into all these obscure texts, but I promise you that in the next lecture we'll be back on more familiar territory of the Gospels, so please do come back for the next one. We'll see in the lecture tomorrow that the argument for pre-existence of Christ in the I have come sayings is actually reinforced when we look at these sayings themselves. Thanks very much.